Good afternoon. You're listening to the LaRouche Show on for December 6th, 2014. My name is Bruce Director, and I will be your host this week. So we have with us today two very good friends of mine, Hussein Askari and Dean Andromedis, both from the European section of the LaRouche movement. Hussein is speaking to us from Sweden and Dean from Germany. And we're going to be discussing the developments in Egypt, which I'm sure most of our listeners, unless you've read the articles by Dean and Hussein in the EIR, you would be completely surprised to find out what's happening there. As most of our listeners know, we're in a very turning point in world history right now, where on the one hand, you have a dying transatlantic system, which is falling apart, as Dean and Hussein can attest. The European economies are all sinking and collapsing and degenerating, as is the case here in North America. But meanwhile, what's happening around the world is countries like China, Russia, India, the BRICS nations are actually investing in development, major development projects, frontier technologies like space development. And this actually is the most hopeful thing that's happening for mankind. The future of mankind is being guided by what's happening in the BRICS nations. Now, one of the most volatile regions in the world is obviously the region of North Africa, Southwest Asia, which has, in most people's minds, is a region that's dominated by degeneration, terrorism, collapse, anarchy, and so forth. And yet there's some remarkable developments happening in this region, which really pose the question most starkly about these this conflict between the collapsing transatlantic system and the hopeful developments of the BRICS system. And that's the developments in Egypt. Now, as many of you know, Egypt has gone through a quite tumultuous period over the last several years with a so-called colored revolution that emerged in Egypt that overthrew the Mubarak regime and ushered in a Muslim Brotherhood regime, and then that was overthrown by the current government. And we'll be talking about that, but I think it's important also to recognize that Egypt, like China, has a thousand-year-old civilization. In fact, the roots of European civilization are centered, arise originally out of Egypt. And so this is a fascinating area of the world to understand and to watch, and I think it's quite important to have this discussion on the LaRouche Show today, because most of the people in Europe and North America are completely unaware of the significance of what's happening in that region. So we're going to get into that, and I'd like to welcome Hussein and Dean to the show today.
Thank you, Bruce.
So let's begin with you, Hussein, and give us a synopsis of these dramatic changes which have happened in Egypt over the recent period.
Yes, thank you, Bruce. Well, what people call the revolution in Egypt, which started in around January 2011. And I say it's a so-called revolution. I will come back to why I say that. But it actually started in Tunisia, the so-called Arab Spring. It's not a revolution. You can call it an uprising or a volcano, which erupted because of the unbearable injustice which was done to the populations in North Africa specifically as a result of actually implementing policies which originate from the transatlantic region, IMF and World Bank policies, free trade agreements with the EU and Mediterranean region, which made these nations subordinate economically using their scarce water resources to produce vegetables and fruits to Europe and their valuable labor force as slave labor for European and other countries' offshore industries. And that led to the eruption of the crisis. Of course, that was combined with political oppression As these governments of Tunisia, Egypt, and many of these countries were allies of the United States and Europe in the war against terrorism. So political oppression was okay. People were sent from all over the world for torture with CIA airplanes to these countries. But when the eruption took place, then suddenly the leaders who were yesterday's allies were now dispensable. And the Obama administration played a key role in, you know, demanding principally that President Mubarak leaves the power without having a clear idea what will come instead. So this volcano threw a lot of ashes around the place, but it was not an organized revolution with very concrete ideas, with a clear leadership. So what you have happening is that the Muslim Brotherhood, who were the most organized political group in Egypt, with support from Saudi Arabia and other wealthy countries, they simply took power in the country and they took the elections, both the parliamentary and presidential elections.
Let me just interject here and ask you to just give our listeners a little background on the Muslim Brotherhood and their origin and who they are and where this comes from, because people hear that term and they hear lots about different Islamist movements around around the North Africa and the Middle East region. But the Muslim Brotherhood was actually created in the transatlantic region out of the British Empire, correct?
Yes, yes. The British Empire, I mean, already in the beginning of the 20th century, but also specifically during World War One, because they were occupying Egypt and occupying, after the war, they were occupying most countries in the Middle East. There were revolts in these countries, national revolts. In Egypt was the strongest. We had in Iraq, we had in Syria, against the British occupation and French occupation, their allies. But the British, they invented this thing already early on, that instead of nationalism, they could plant something else, which is very vague, and that's Islamism. And they recruited people like the Mufti of Egypt at the time when the British took over, Mohammed Abdel. He was a close friend of Evelyn Baring from the Baring banking family, who was collecting the Egyptian debt in the late 19th century. But then he was appointed as the governor of Egypt, or the proconsul of Egypt. And he brought Mohammed Abdel from exile, where he had joined the Freemasonic Orient Lodge in Paris. And they appointed him as the Mufti in order to start a movement which was so-called Islamic reform. And Mohammed Abdul's position was that we can never have political freedom before we understand Islam correctly. So there's no point fighting against the British. We have to reform our souls and ourselves from inside before we can fight the British. So that was his position. He helped the British occupation to loot the Egyptian farmers and Egyptian economy many years.
So this so-called Islamist movement then is not sort of a representation of the beliefs and aspirations of the people in these countries.
No.
Who are predominantly Muslim, but not only Muslim. There's other religions in these countries as well, right?
Yes, yes, yes. You had nationalists in each Arab country. There were nationalist movements who wanted to free themselves from British and French colonialism. They were fed up with the Ottoman colonialism, and when the British and French came and defeated the Ottomans, they became their new rulers. And they lied to the Arabs that they will give them independence and freedom after the war. That was a big lie. The Sykes-Picot Agreement already under the war redefined the whole region as a sphere of influence for France and Britain. So they lied to the people. So you had nationalist, patriotic revolts against British and French occupation. And in each country, although people talk about pan-Arabism, actually in each country, Iraq, Syria, Egypt, you had a very distinct identity, because these are very old civilizations. And these were empires on their own before. So the British invented the pan-Islamic idea as a vague, borderless, globalized idea, which can never be concretized. and which can be used against the nationalists.
Specifically against the idea of national development. So in Egypt,
exactly.
In Egypt, you know, earlier in the post-war period, you had the reemergence of the nationalist identity, right, with President Nasser. Why don't you just fill us in a little bit about that, just to bring us up to date, so people have this history.
Yes, the British were in control of, you know, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the Arab Emirates, all these Gulf corrupt, and the monarchy in Jordan. And then you had Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, and in Egypt, and North Africa, you had Republican movements, which through military coups and revolts, they overthrew the monarchs or the monarchies and established republics. And in Egypt was the best example of it. But the British used their assets inside Egypt and in Iraq by saying all these nationalists are actually not nationalists. These are God-denying communists. You know, uh-huh. So to mobilize the population and religious institutions against them. And then they used this whole, in the Cold War, this became strengthened with the United States, NATO, supporting the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamists, you know, to fight against the nationalist leaders, like Abdel Nasser in Egypt, like Abdul Karim Qasim in Iraq. I mean, they killed Abdul Karim Qasim in Iraq in 1961, before he managed to nationalize the British Oil Company. So they used the Islamist card always as a weapon against these national sentiments and the aspirations to establish a republic in these countries. And it's still going on. It's exactly the same thing going on now. They are using these Islamist terrorists. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood were badly defeated inside Egypt, and now in the latest elections in Tunisia. But now you have the mobilization of the militant arms of the offshoots of the Islamic or the Muslim Brotherhood, like you know, Al-Qaeda and ISIS. All these things came out of the umbrella of the Muslim Brotherhood and through the British and American support for the jihadi movement in Afghanistan. So the Islamic card was used both by the British Empire and later by the United States or the alliance of the United States and Britain to attack any regime they did not want. Now they are attacking Russia and China and India and so on and so forth. So last year, I mean, the Egyptian people, they realized, we wrote in EIR a warning that the Muslim Brotherhood's economic program would lead to a new social upheaval and new revolt and a military coup. I myself made that forecast exactly a year before Mohamed Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood president, was overthrown by simply looking at the economic program they were trying to push on the Egyptian people. I mean, Egypt's economy was looted for about 30 years by economic liberalization driven by IMF, World Bank, and the EU. Advice, you know, privatization, liberalization, cutting subsidies to agriculture and industry and infrastructure. So all these things were, under Mubarak's time, the Egyptian economy was almost completely destroyed. And that's what created the background for this revolt in 2011. So the Muslim Brotherhood came in as an alternative, but you look at what they were proposing, an economic policy was just simply a continuation of the IMF. Actually, they were chasing the IMF to get a new loan for $3 billion in order for Egypt to be able to enter the financial markets to borrow more money to buy food and other commodities which Egypt can no longer produce themselves. So that was a very clear sign that the Muslim Brotherhood had no intention of rebuilding the nation. And both for me and later for the Egyptian people, it was very, very clear 1 year later, that was it. And the Muslim Brotherhood were involved in cleansing all the state institutions from any, you know, people who don't support their ideology. And in addition, they were starting to make propaganda for supporting these jihadists in Syria. There were attacks on Shia minority groups inside Egypt, you know, and they were bringing these Saudi clerics to make speeches in stadiums inside Egypt, you know, calling for jihad in Syria, calling for this and that. So people got completely terrified that what is going to happen in Egypt is that it will be worse than Taliban Afghanistan. And therefore, the military institution and the population together went in, you know, to crush the Muslim Brotherhood, and they managed to do that.
And of course, during this whole period, the United States and the EU nations were supporting the Muslim Brotherhood under the guise of democracy.
Yes, because they were elected in the, you know, in the, they got the vote in the elections. The problem is that they, you know, most of the vote was bought,
right,
by their money. I mean, they are very well organized, but because they got enormous resources from Saudi Arabia and other countries, who then they broke with later. Because the Muslim Brotherhood, they have no friends. It's like the British Empire. They have no permanent friends. They have just permanent interests.
Okay, so that you had this revolt, and maybe this is a good point to bring Dean in here. What happened? How did the military acted, and President, or now President al-Sisi, came into power? How was this? How did this happen, and what was the effect of it?
Well, if you remember, you had literally millions of people in the streets of last year, in the streets of Cairo and other big cities, Alexandria and other big cities in Egypt, protesting against the Morsi government. And it was, I mean, when I say millions, we're talking about a large percentage of the population, you know, voting with their feet, so to speak. And this is millions. So the Egyptian army, which has which is actually probably the only people's, what you can call a people's army, in the region, stepped in. And President al-Sisi at that time was defense minister. And he had also played a role in 2011 in the removal of Mubarak in the first phase of the so-called Arab Spring. So the army, with total popular support, and this is not, I mean, Human Rights Watch and the other no good organizations will try to say that, you know, this is a coup and blah, blah, blah. But the popular support is there. And what has happened in the last, in the last year and a half since then, has confirmed that.
Well, just so our listeners understand this, because and either you, Dean, or Hussein, either one of you can answer this, the military as an institution in Egypt is an institution that has popular support, right? You called it a people's army, but it's not like the way people would think of the military in the United States or Germany or Sweden or something like that. This actually is an institution which the people look to as the defender of order and progress in the country.
Well, it's we go back to General, then Colonel, Abdel Gamal Nasser, or Gamal Abdel Nasser, and his so-called Young Officers Movement, and it was sort of a youth movement within the military. These men were actually in their 30s, and the country was ruled by a monarch, by a king who was just a lackey of the British, who still, they controlled the canal, they controlled Egypt, and this group in the army took over overthrew the monarchy, put him on a ship, and the guy went off to Italy. And they established a republic, and with massive, massive support, which has not, this tradition in the military has continued with ups and downs, so to speak. And now the military itself is very much involved in the economy, not in the way of old owning companies and things like this, but an example is, the most important example is the Egyptian Army Corps of Engineers, which is a very, very large establishment, similar to the United States, where the Army Corps of Engineers is responsible for all marine and inland waterway infrastructure in the United States. In Egypt, the Army Corps of Engineers is involved in a whole spectrum of infrastructure projects, ranging from roads, housing, electricity infrastructure. They're the ones that are supervising the expansion of the Suez Canal. And it's a conscript army with a very large engineering corps. Many of the thousands of, you know, the, I think Egypt has 500,000 engineers, many of which went through the military and the military engineering corps in their younger days. So the military is, in a sense, is a, an army of the people, and has the prestige to carry this out, and that is what happened.
Well, this is a good point to sort of get right to the point. Now that people have this background, is that okay? So you had, as Hussein's described to us, the collapse, the destruction of the Egyptian economy under the pressure from the IMF, World Bank, and transatlantic powers, the looting of the country, the shifting away from engineering, industry, and development into an export-oriented economy for fruits and vegetables and tourism. Of course, Egypt is relied heavily on tourism. So that led to an uprising, brought in another British operation, the Muslim Brotherhood. The economy continued to collapse, and the army reacted and made a complete change. So I don't know which one of you wants to address this, or if Hussein wants to jump in here. Tell us what happened. I mean, this is quite dramatic, right? Because they went from an economy which was completely collapsing to initiating some of the most ambitious development programs on the planet right now.
Well, let me just, I tell you what I, let me go through the through some of the projects in terms of the canal, and then I think I'd like Hussein to also jump in.
Good.
On the whole question of the agricultural policy and now the whole regional
Can I say just something quick on the characteristic of the situation? Because, you know what, I think the Egyptian leadership, Al-Sisi personally, but other people around him, they realize that the only way you can cope with the destabilization, the terrorism, the unemployment, the pressure from the IMF and the World Bank is to redefine a national mission, a mission for the nation which will be sustained by the people and the government itself, not with support from the outside, not reliance on the outside. Of course, the Egyptian government continues to get financial backing from the wealthy Gulf states, but that's another story. But the reality is, you know, in, as we in the LaRouche movement proposed to the Al-Sisi government, or immediately after the revolt last year against the Muslim Brotherhood, we said, look, the Muslim Brotherhood failed because they did not define a national mission. I mean, we pointed out to the fact that first the government must go out, the new president will go out on TV, this was my proposal, and announce that we have a national mission to rebuild the economy, which is based on building infrastructure, rebuilding the agriculture and industry of the country, and mass employment for the youth. Number two is that they will establish a national development bank to finance these projects internally, not resorting to international financial institutions, not resorting to so-called financial markets and so on. Because inside Egypt, you do have 10 times more what the IMF can offer you. The problem is that people were hiding the money under the mattresses. Wealthy people had, you know, shipped the money abroad or investing in Dubai and other places and real estate bubbles. These resources have to be channeled back into a national mission. Now, what the government did is not, as Dean can explain, they did not establish a national development bank but they did like Ethiopia did with their dam project, dam building project, is that they would sell bonds or shares in these national projects so people, the population, can buy shares in the new projects, which is, it's a smart way of doing things, but it has its limitations. It's better to go with a national development bank. But that's what happened. I think they realized they have to define a mission for developing the whole nation, but relying on their own resources.
You see,
go ahead, Dean.
Go ahead, Dean.
The thing is also, the character of this is that, that Al-Sisi is taking leadership for the entire region. And it's a region that, I mean, Egypt is not just a country that one associates with the Middle East and the Arab world. It is very much an African country as well, and a Mediterranean country, with which is a neighbor of Europe. And Al-Sisi is being seen as a regional, if not in a certain sense, a global leader that that hasn't surfaced in this part of the world in probably since Gamal Abdel Nasser in 1952, when he came to power in 1952. And this is very, very important because the development of Egypt, its strategic location between the Mediterranean, the link of the Suez Canal with the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean and the Far East, and its link to southern sub-Saharan Africa and North Africa, makes this, this very, very clear. And also, the whole question of the of the youth, that that the policy for the region as a cornerstone has to see the development of their youth as at the center of this, because that's what the British with this with radical fundamentalism is targeting. That's what they want to destroy.
And in Egypt, like most of these developing countries, has a majority population of youth. That's correct, right?
Yes, and I give you an example. I mean, all these projects, when they announce these projects, like for instance, the of course, what is the most visible mega project, and that's what they call it, is the doubling the size of the Suez Canal.
Okay, let's just do this. We have about 4 minutes before the break, and I want to get into the details of these different projects, or at least some detail, but just to give our listeners a sense of the scope of these things, can you just list, sort of in summary form, just list the number, the projects, and how the big. So they're doubling the Suez Canal. Then there's other major development projects, correct?
Yes, there's the agricultural projects. They want to reclaim 4 million acres of agricultural land, which is now basically desert. This is being done in several ways. One is a so-called Tusker project. This is a project that was initiated more than 10 years ago. And the idea was to bring water with a canal, which has already been built, from Lake Nasser, which is the lake behind the Aswan Dam, and to irrigate something like a million hectares of land. This was half built under Mubarak, and then laid dormant because his idea was to sell this to give the land over to Arab sheikhs and large corporations to develop so-called industrial agriculture, and they ended up doing nothing. But this project now is going forward with the idea of offering land to young college graduates, university graduates, so they can start modern agricultural farms and businesses. That's one project. That's a very, very large project.
Then, that's also part of the development corridor, which was proposed by Doc. Yeah, sorry.
The other project is a project that was proposed 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, by Dr. Fuad Al-Baz, who is a friend of the Schiller Institute. He is the director of the Remote Sensing Institute in Boston, and he is now one of the members of President Al-Sisi's scientific committee. And this project is to basically create, it's part of the so-called New Nile Valley project. And this is to create a New Nile Valley in the western desert of Egypt. Now, 99% of the population practically lives on 5% of the land, which is basically a thin strip of land along the Nile River and the Nile Delta. And the idea is to build a new Nile Valley to the west of that. And Dr. Baz's project was to first build a superhighway, a north-south superhighway, between the Nile Valley and a series of oases in the western desert that go, there's five of them that go from the north to the south. And this would be the basis to establish railroads, water pipelines, and whatnot, and bring the population, bring 20 million people into the western desert, which would be reclaimed.
Okay, I want to get the details of these projects, but let me just take a moment here to identify ourselves to all our listeners that this is, you're listening to the LaRouche Show for December 6, 2014, and I'm joined by Hussein Askari and Dina Andromedis, and we're talking about the tremendous developments in Egypt. Now, okay, so you've listed three of the major projects. Why don't we sort of fill our listeners in? I don't know if Hussein, you want to jump in here.
Yeah, there are other. There's, for example, in connection with the new Suez Canal, there's a whole plan to develop the whole Suez Canal zone by building industrial centers, industries, not sweatshops, but industries, and to expand that development by both bringing water and power into Sinai, the Sinai Peninsula, mm-hmm. which is almost a desert area, to develop the Sinai and bring more population to the area, as they will do with the Western Desert, but also to cope with this spreading of these Islamist jihadist movements, and they grow inside these almost Bedouin societies and poor societies on the Suez, on the Sinai Peninsula. So that's one major piece to connect back Sinai to the motherland, Egypt, and also use Sinai, the Sinai Peninsula, as a connection to Asia. There's an old project to build a bridge over, or a tunnel, actually, under the Aqaba, Gulf of Aqaba, to Saudi Arabia and Jordan, and from there to rest of Asia. Now they are building new tunnels also under the Suez Canal to Sinai Peninsula. So there's a whole complex of agro-industrial centers being proposed. Now there's also, you know, to do all these things, you need enormous amount of power and energy too, not only manpower and machines, and therefore the idea, the revival of the Egyptian nuclear program is advancing. Now, the government said they're going to go ahead with the first nuclear power plant, which will be in the Mediterranean coast, further northwest of Cairo, a bit, you know, like about 300 kilometers away. But that's also part of the idea, is to bring communities to the desert areas. Now, as Dean said, you know, Egypt's biggest problem is that, you know, 80 million people live on only 5% of the land and use 5% of the land. So there's Dr. Farouk Elbaz's idea is a revolutionary idea in a sense, but also the resources do exist for agro-industrial development in that new valley west of the Nile, because you have the manpower, skilled labor force, but you also have the resources. You have fertile land. You have, actually, Dr. Farouk Elbaz is relying a lot of his knowledge of remote sensing and his knowledge of the existence of enormous untapped groundwater resources, which is under this whole desert region between Egypt, Libya, Sudan, and Chad. You have what is called the Grand Sandstone Nubian Aquifer, which is not a simple aquifer. You know, it contains enormous amounts, unimaginable amounts of fresh water, which can, you know, could be used for hundreds of years. Of course, Elbaz is saying we have to use it cautiously, but it exists there for our use. There are many, many hundreds and thousands of times the amount of water of the Nile that exists under the sands of the desert. And Dr. Farouk Elbaz knows that as a fact, but there is an international, like the environmentalist movement, the UN and others, they discourage the use of groundwater. But Elbaz says, you know, we are in a war situation. We need to develop the country. We're going to use that. You also have in these regions very large mineral resources, copper, iron ore, other rare earth, so-called rare earth minerals that can be used to develop new industrial centers. So it's not simply going there and growing more food. It's building agro-industrial centers and new civilizational centers in the Western Desert, which could, you know, revolutionize the Egyptian people's relationship to the Nile and to their country. So they are no longer just Nile people. They are part of the whole Egyptian landscape. And this, of course, would spill over, as we, Dean and I wrote, this massive mobilization of the resources of the country in combination with the major push from the BRICS countries, China, Russia, India, Brazil, and South Africa, into this new paradigm of massive development and a completely new way of financing major infrastructure projects, because Egypt is using, actually, and is going to use more in the coming months, the major thrust of the BRICS and specifically China. I mean, the Chinese are directly involved in this whole new Suez Canal project region and the industrial zones there, because this is very important for China's, you know, future trade with Europe. It will affect everything there. The Chinese are backing an Egyptian international economic conference, which will be held in mid-March, and the Chinese are the big, actually the largest participants in that, because they do want to promote Egypt and the new Egyptian government's policies for national and regional development. And this is very, very important, because that takes this whole question from being an Egyptian affair into a regional and global affair. And as Dean and I have written, is that we have to look not only at what the impact of Egypt's development program is on the other African nations, like Ethiopia, they are on the way. You have other catastrophe areas like Sudan, South Sudan, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, Kenya. These nations are also entering a new phase in their economic existence and livelihood, which is also pushed by this BRICS and China's thrust into the region. But the method being used there is exactly the same in a sense. I mean, they don't have the internal resources. China has to finance lots of infrastructure projects we can go through soon. But this whole idea of national development based on developing the internal part of the country, using all the possible internal resources to get the country above this bare existence level and thrusting them into an industrial era, is spreading in this region. Like Ethiopia is a good example of this.
I want to pick up on that in a second in terms of the global implications of this development around Egypt. But let me go back also just to the Suez Project, because I think one of the most startling things about this is the speed at which this project is being developed. I remember that we reported that Al-Sisi went on television and said, we're going to do this project, and within a days of him making this announcement, they already started moving dirt. So can one of you give us a just a sense of exactly how rapidly they're moving on this? I mean, when you think of a project like doubling the Suez Canal, you think of something that's like going to take 10 years to get started, but they seem to be moving very quickly.
Well, Al-Sisi gave his speech on August 5th at the Canal Zone, and that, as soon as the speech ended, that's when the project started. So it was inaugurated. So originally they had planned that the project would have been done in 5 years. And he said, no, we have to do it in 1 year. Therefore, the project is going to be supervised by the Army Corps of Engineers, the Egyptian Army Corps of Engineers. And we are not going to have any foreign financing or any foreign companies taking part in the project of the canal itself, because the canal has to stay within control of Egypt and the Egyptian government, because it's the major asset that belongs to the Egyptian people for the use of the world. So as soon as he finished his speech, 20,000 workers started digging the project. So virtually every company that has the large bulldozers and dump trucks needed has been deployed into the canal zone and now I think they're close to almost halfway done with the project. So it's on time and they're ahead of time. And if you Google Suez Canal in Google videos and get it for like the last month or so, you can see videos of the digging, and it looks like they're digging the Grand Canyon. It's just unbelievable. And the idea is that the canal zone is about 170 kilometers long, and in between you have these lakes. So there are two sections that they have to widen. They don't have to widen the lakes, obviously. So in the north, it's about 30 kilometers, and in the south, it's another 30, 35 kilometers. In the north, they're building an entirely separate canal parallel to the old canal, so they can have two-way traffic. I think they're doing it this way in the north because you have Port Said in the north. That's a big, they have a very big container terminal there for transshipment, and they want to double the size of that. In the south, they are dredging to make to double the width of the canal in that southern half. And there, they have actually hired something like six or seven foreign dredging firms, because they just don't have enough dredgers themselves. And all this, for instance, the largest American dredging company has been hired. The three or four largest European dredging companies have been hired, and they're all very excited about this project, because they say this is a world historic project and real challenge. So as we're speaking now, 40,000 Egyptians and something like 80 companies are working 24 hours a day to double the size of this canal. Now, in addition to that, they are going to build seven tunnels underneath the canal. Now, including three railroad tunnels. Now, this is important because it's not just to get to the other side of the canal. You don't need seven tunnels just to get on the other side of the canal and develop the Sinai. It's not that big. But it's clear what they're thinking of is linking. They're already thinking post-war. They're already thinking that the Middle East wars are going to stop, and we're going to have development. So those canals, particularly the railroad canals, one of them will be a railroad canal that would go up the coast of the Mediterranean, through Gaza, through Israel, Lebanon, Syria, and into Europe. The another one would go towards Israel and Jordan and into Saudi Arabia and further up into Iraq, Iran, and into Central Asia. And another one will most likely be used to go a little bit further south into the Arabian Peninsula and the Gulf. But this is the way they are thinking about it. It's not just a project for Egypt itself. I mean, in the other direction, Egypt already has a railroad along the Mediterranean. The idea would be to link that railroad to a railroad in Libya, which they started to build. The Russians and the Chinese had started to build that before the British decided to overthrow Gaddafi and destroy the country. But now that project, you know, is important to get that project going again, because Tunisia, Algeria are building railroads along the coast, and Morocco is already building they're halfway done with their high-speed connection between Tangiers and Casablanca. So this is the way the countries in the region are thinking.
So this gets back also to what Hussein was talking about, which is what I'd like, Hussein, you could jump in here, or maybe other people, Dean, you could also speak on what you were saying about the importance of this real development in Egypt as an engine for a transformation of really not just Africa and the Middle East, but the whole Eurasian continent. And how does this hook in both economically and politically with this whole BRICS development project? You want to take a stab at that, Hussein?
Yes. Well, you see, I think what the Egyptians are doing it will be inspiring. And also with connection with what the Chinese are doing in East Africa, it will inspire the whole continent of Africa. I mean, this is what we wrote in our report. Because Africa's destiny, it has to be integrated. If you look at the population centers in Africa, they go along the Nile River and the east part of the continent. These are the largest populations. And then goes south to all the way down to South Africa. Then you have North Africa, just a thin rim on the coast of the Mediterranean, going all the way from Egypt all the way to Morocco, and then goes down the Atlantic coast down the whole way to South Africa again. But in between, you have desert, you have jungles and wars, but you have enormous amounts of resources and possibilities for development. Because the resources of Africa, in spite of all the looting, I mean, there is still Africa is very, very rich. But for Africa to develop, it has to get out of the colonial system, which was the idea you build a railway, with a narrow gauge from the mine to the first port you hit. And that's it. This is Africa has been under the colonial system. So all the railways, for example, in Africa, in East Africa, have different gauges depending on which company, which country, which colonial country occupied them. And they just go a short trip from a mining area or a plantation area to the port.
And this is one of the projects that the Chinese have publicly pledged themselves to, which is to link up all the African population centers by high-speed rail.
Yeah, exactly. This is the what is called now, for example, in Kenya, they just started, they launched the project, which is called the Lamu Corridor, which goes from not Mombasa, which is the famous port in Kenya, in East Africa, but goes from Lamu further north, closer to the Somali border, all the way inland to connect South Sudan and Ethiopia to these... Ethiopia is landlocked. South Sudan is landlocked. Uganda is landlocked. So there are a series of development corridors which the East African nations have been thinking about, but they were never, ever supported either by the United States or the EU or the World Bank or the IMF. It was almost prohibited for these nations to build these projects. Theoretically, there were plans on the table, but they were on the shelves. But now the Chinese are coming in and say, okay, let's build all these things. So they are building these connections both between the countries of East Africa, but even inside each country, like in Ethiopia. They are building a completely new railway system, connecting the north to the south of the country, connecting the center of the country to the to Djibouti on the Red Sea, where they have the major port. I mean, Ethiopia is 90 million people, and the only way for international markets is through one old railway or some roads to Djibouti. But now Ethiopia will be connected not only by a new high-speed railway to Djibouti, it will be connected southward to Kenya, it will be connected to Sudan, it will be connected to South Sudan, Uganda, and so on and so forth. I mean, you have a big obstacle there, which is Somalia. If we have time, we can talk about the threat of terrorism to all these nations, which have this one source, generally.
That brings you know, up a really important point, because I'm sitting here listening to you talk about, you know, all these different countries linking up together, and you think, you know, how's this going to happen with the political conflicts which have been virtually embedded in there since because of the colonial period? What's actually happening with the is there progress happening in terms of the multilateral and bilateral relations among African nations with the Chinese, with the Russians, with the BRICS countries?
Yeah, I think if you look at what the Chinese have done is that they bring together Rwanda, Burundi, Uganda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Ethiopia, and South Sudan, you know, with Kenya, and say, you are one group. You know, you have one interest. We're going to help you to develop. That's the way you get out of this all these civil wars. And these governments, they are, of course, they know that stability in their country will depend first and foremost on building the country, because even though, I mean, some of the leaders, they have been sitting there for many years, they know they cannot control a situation where, you know, poverty, famine, and rebel groups thrive on, you know, this destructive economic policy which has been pushed by the British for many, many years, looting the country's minerals, buying weapons. That's what has been going on. So they actually, I mean, last year when the Prime Minister of China, Li Qiang, came to East Africa, we brought together all these leaders from Rwanda, Burundi, Uganda, South Sudan, and Kenya, and they signed one joint agreement. They know that, you know, their survival depends on working together. And the Chinese have offered them a way of working together by building national and transnational standard railways, roads, water systems, energy systems, and so on. So these nations can both exchange goods and services amongst themselves, come to international markets. I mean, as we wrote in our report, Dean and I, it's like the transport cost in this region is the highest in the world. Because if you want to send a container from Singapore or China to any of these countries, you know, it will cost twice as much as sending it to Germany. Because there are no appropriate roads, there are no railways, there are no effective transport systems. And this means a big disaster for the economy, economic development of these nations. So without adequate transport systems and what we call a, you know, unified, if you take this region, as Mr. LaRouche defines, you know, the idea of having a one unit of action, one unit of organization, and you take all these countries of the Nile Basin and East Africa, because they do have common, not only resources and borders, they have the Nile River And they have other means, but you have to connect them with what we call multi-modular transport systems, which means you will have the same standard as happens in Europe for all the railways, all the roads, all the containers, even size of the containers, the size of the trucks, the size of the ships, the ferries, all these things. They have to be unified all along the whole region, from Egypt down to South Africa, but specifically among these nations. So the transport system from ships to railway to trucks to rivers goes smoothly because you have standardized sizes and systems. This is what is going to happen now.
Well, let me ask you this, Dean. You might want to jump in here. You know, what you're describing, what the two of you have been describing is exhilarating, and you see this tremendous potential for development and how beneficial this is not only for the people in the region, but also for mankind as a whole. Is there any recognition in Europe, among European business and political leaders, of this opportunity? Or is the European thinking as bankrupt as it is, say, for example, with Russia, where they're only interested in confrontation with Russia rather than the extraordinary development potential which exists?
Well, let me just say something. I mean, as far as European official EU policy, it's hopeless. The Europeans are, the EU is still concerned about saving its totally bankrupt financial system, just as Obama is. And the situation in Greece and the so-called bailed out countries is getting worse and worse and worse. But there's a question, I think, which is very important about General al-Sisi, or President al-Sisi. It's a question of leadership. And he has demonstrated that he is a leader that is committed to transforming not only his country, but the entire region. And that is beginning to be recognized in Europe, at least from a political security standpoint. So if you look at who al-Sisi has visited, or who is visiting him in terms of official trips, just very quickly, when he became president, the special envoys from the president of China, the prime minister of Japan, Russia, etc., went to congratulate him and deliver messages to al-Sisi, which are, in fact, invitations to visit their country. So the first country he visited was Russia of this round. He is now going to visit China. He will visit South Korea, which is very, very important, because South Korea is a major producer of
ports and shipbuilding.
Power stations.
Right, and ports and shipbuilding.
and shipbuilding. He will
actually, the South Koreans, they just signed a memorandum of understanding with the Egyptian government on working together on nuclear power, although there are no direct agreements of building nuclear power plants. But it's well known that South Korea is one of the very active countries in building nuclear power plants. They are building four of these in the United Arab Emirates just now. Work going on mm-hmm. on the ground. So South Korea has a very important role there, both because of their effectiveness, but also that they are politically not in hot waters like other nuclear power builders like Russia or China in relationship to Europe and the United States. So they are more neutral, so to speak, and they are capable of doing this kind of work. So there are going to be some nuclear power agreements between Egypt and South Korea. Sorry, Dean,
Well, back to Europe, it's interesting that al-Sisi, just in the last couple of weeks, was in Italy and he was in France. And these two countries immediately sent their defense ministers and foreign ministers to Cairo. And they all are going to participate in this investment conference, aid conference, which Hussein mentioned earlier, that's going to take place in March and bring people from all over the world, particularly China, the Middle East, Europe, and the United States. So I think because of the leadership role that Al-Sisi has chosen to take, and when a person demonstrates leadership, you either get a reaction from the British Empire against him, or you get a reaction of people who are in crisis in all these countries being attracted to that and wanting to cooperate with that leadership. Let me just mention, that's the criminality of the Obama administration.
Well, I hate to cut you off, because the point you just made is obviously the key point, but we're about out of time.
Oh, okay.
And I just want to say that this has been a really exciting show today, and a tremendous explanation, an example of the point you just made about leadership and the development, dedicating your nation to the development of the other. So let me thank both Hussein and Dean for being with us today, and we have obviously a lot more to cover, so hopefully we'll have you on again soon. So thank you very much for being with us today, and thank you, listeners, for listening to The LaRouche Show.